Good morning. Welcome to the portfolio meeting of human settlement. Hoping that everybody is present, actually. I don't understand what's happening on my left. Yeah, no. Welcome to this meeting of the portfolio committee of human settlement. We hope that the rain and the weather site didn't prepare your brain into functioning well today in what we are going to deal with. According to the items that we are going to be dealing with today, we are expecting a report on progress on the blue paper on human settlement from the department. And again, we will all remember that the report on the commission of inquiry on the Ulwandle eviction was tabled in parliament by the minister and then sent over to us to deal with as the committee. So that report will then be tabled to us today. But I'm going to start with the green paper on human settlement. The department will start with that item first, and then we will deal with the report on Rwanda. The officials from the department, they will be introducing themselves, but I think I, Dr. Sokoko, are you the one that's going to present? Yes. We'll introduce ourselves and then we'll then report it, we'll give a progress report on the current paper. We all know that this is one of the key things that we've talked about in the committee, that one of the major things is that the human settlement doesn't have a policy document on this, on human settlement, and one of the things that we are dealing with both as the committee and as the department to make sure that we have this piece of legislation. Over to you, Dr. Sokoko.
Thank you very much. I'm Soleka Kokopo from the Department of Human Settlement. I'm going to present how far we are in the development of a green paper for human settlement. So briefly, I would just remind you why we are developing a green paper and what is the process in terms of development and how does it now fit into the National Development Plan and what's the new vision for human settlements, and then mainly the progress is basically on the focus, what are we going to be focusing on and what are the challenges that we are addressing, because there are many challenges, as you know, regarding the issues on human settlements. The reason we the Department of Human Settlements has embarked on the development the reason the Department of Human Settlements has started embarking on the development of the green paper is because we need a 20 to 30 year strategy for the development of human settlements. The built environment by itself needs a long term plan. Mm-hmm. And that's why then we need then to have a 20 to 30 year plan around issues of development of human settlements. That's the best output of the green paper. Also, we need to establish a foundation for the review and development of legislation on human settlements. The chair has indicated that we do not have currently the policy on human settlements. What we have is the housing policy. Also, the issues of developing human settlements, those are some of the outputs that we need to be looking at for this current 5 year term. The development process, as you all know, it's a step-by-step process and kind of a very tedious process. So the first step is to determine what should we achieve. What is it that we want to achieve in terms of human settlements? So what is the impact on society? What is it that we want to change in society? Those are the first things that we want to deal with. As you know, that government since 2009 had adopted an outcome-based approach. Hence, we start by saying, what is it that we want to achieve? What changes do we want to make in society? And then we also say what are the long-term outcomes that we want to achieve to give us the impact that we want to do. So that's how we have done that. We you then say what are the issues, what's the analysis, and we need to understand what is the problem with the human settlements. We've been developing human settlements in the past 20 years, even if we didn't call it human settlements, but what are the current problems? And we do need to understand the problem, because if we misdiagnose the problem, it means then that whatever alternative solutions that we come up with, if we're not diagnosing the problem correctly, then we will miss the point. Also, the resources that we have are not unlimited. So we do need to have the comparative analysis of what are the options, what's the data that is telling us. So we are currently going through that process. And then also, what are the policy options that we have? If we do this, what are the consequences of this? So we need to also look at various options, because we cannot have one option and say, what's the conceptual framework? What is the thinking? What's the ideology behind? Then identify the expected outcomes and then the development of policy options as I. We have to go through the consultative process. That is just going to be starting in November, and this is part of the consultative process. Still, we do need to determine who are we going to consult, on what are we going to consult, when, where, why are we going to consult, because we can't just consult for sake of consulting, and how, because one side cannot fit all. If you want to consult a certain stakeholder, you have to approach differently, because what you want is different. If you want to approach the people that are going to benefit from the program, you approach them differently. So and you also determine what is it that you want out of that. So we will go through that process of saying who do we want to approach, what are we going to be talking to them about, when, where, why, and how the consultation. Also, one of the weaknesses in policy development is that we usually do not talk about monetary issues. We do not talk about evaluation issues when we're developing policy. The tendency for us is to start developing policy and stop there. And we don't say, if we want to if we're developing this policy, what are the indicators of performance? If we're going to be successful, what is it that we want to see? So we do need to then develop performance because this is the integral part of the process, as it assists in the refinement of the expected outcomes. Because once you have the policy, one of the major successes in policy implementation is ability to refine. And those performance measures will help us to refine particular implementation. We need to then make decisions on the indicators and whether data sources exist or and what are the kind of data sources that we need. And currently, in the development of policy, what are the data policies that currently exist, whether they are efficient or they need to be reviewed. We do know what's the vision, because it's there in the National Development Plan, the vision of human settlements. It's there. But I would like to remind you that it says that because it's a long term, it says by 2050 we shall have visible results from effectively coordinated spatial planning system, and we shall have transformed human settlements in South Africa into equitable and efficient spaces with citizens living in close proximity to work and access to social facilities and necessary infrastructure. So by 2050, these are the kind of human settlements that we want. But in order for us to reach 2050, to reach that vision in 2050, we need to make sure that the steps that we are developing now lead us to that 2050. As a result, we develop a shorter version which goes to 2030. That says that by 2030, measurable progress shall have been made towards breaking up the spatial pattern. As you know, for the past 20 years, we've been talking about this and wanting, and unfortunately have successes in some areas and not so much success in other areas, but we say that we shall have made significant progress towards retrofit existing settlements, offering the majority of Africans access to adequate housing, affordable services in best living environments, within a more equitable and functional residential property market. So what it means is that the green paper should set us towards that 2050, but at the same time lay the foundation for the 2050 vision. This is the definition of human settlement region. Now, that definition of human settlement was based from the comprehensive plan. I'm sure you all know it as BHS, from the comprehensive plan for the development of sustainable human settlements. That says that human settlements are well-developed entities in which economic growth and social development are in balance with caring coverage of the natural systems in which they depend for their existence and result in sustainable development, wealth creation, poverty, alleviation, and equity. And that's the working definition that we are using for the Green Paper. We have, as I indicated, that one of the major issues is to determine what are the outcomes. And we said that our outcomes, even for the 2050 vision of the Green Paper, is to ensure that we have sustainable human settlement and improved quality of also life. That's what we want. So not only because that outcome is for two parts. One is the sustainability of settlements. The second aspect of that outcome is talking about now individuals that are within those settlements to make sure that we are improving their lives. What is it that we need to be doing to ensure that we achieve that? I will talk to that later on. And then the intermediate outcome are saying that they make sure that we ensure that there's adequate housing and improved quality of living environment. Also, we make sure that we have a functionally equitable residential property market, and also we ensure that we have enhanced institutional capability so that we make correct special investment decisions. Because the reasons we have done that diagnosis and said that it's because if you want to break the special form, the current special form, we have to make better investment decisions in terms of your space. And currently, you're not allocating the resources that you have correctly. And if you notice that these very same outcomes are there in our current 5-year plan, which is your medium framework, your MTFF. What are then these quality of life indicators? Because remember that we said that we want there's two parts in our house. One is the sustainable human settlement aspect. And then there's the other part that says improved quality of household life. So just going to talk first about the quality indicators. What is it that you want? We want to make sure that everyone is access to housing by ensuring that there's security of care. And you do know that we've been working on this since 1994, security of care. But we have not done much around housing cost and affordability. Dealing with household clothing, government household provision, urban housing intensification, housing accessibility, all those are the indicators that we are going to be working on. Remember that we said that one of the important things for us to determine the indicators now, so that when we assess the progress, whether it's 10 years from now, we use the same indicator to see that this is how far we've gone. The built environment, the look and feel of our cities, land use, traffic and transport issues, so that, for example, one of the criticisms that we have had in terms of human settlements, that our planning, this juncture between our human settlements plan and transport planning, so particularly public transport, access, inability for us to ensure that there's access to services, and also that there's the sparseness of our settlements, that we need to start densifying our settlements. Also, we cannot develop settlements without dealing with issues around safety. How do our settlement planning ensure that there's safety, particularly for women? What are the perceptions of safety, road safety, workplace safety, and all of those things are some of the things that we need to keep in mind. And you know that some of it are not solely the prerogative of human settlements. We need to ensure that other departments are part of the loop of human settlements. Social connectedness also. We do know that the National Development Plan calls for a holistic approach. That's why I indicated to you that we cannot, as the Department of Human Settlements, be alone. It says that in order for us to have a decent standard of living, all these aspects need to be there. Your housing, your water, sanitation, electricity, clean environment, recreation and leisure, nutrition, healthcare, employment, education, transport, and all of them. We need to adopt a holistic approach. And that's what we would try to deal with in terms of the creation of saying who is responsible for what in the development of humanity. Now, let's deal with the fiscal aspect to the sustainability aspect of human development. Remember, I guess earlier on with the improvement in household life. Now, let's deal with the sustainability part of human development. We have got two aspects, the physical aspect and the other aspect that are not physical. The physical aspect basically share its infrastructure, its services. And sometimes is that we tend to put more focus on shelter and put less on infrastructure and services. So we need to have that kind of balance between provision of shelter, infrastructure, and services. And what we mean by that is that when we talk about shelter, we talk about the structures of different shapes, sizes, and move away from the one that fits all. When we talk about the infrastructure, we're talking about the network of goods and services, how we transport water, energy, information. So what we're talking about when we're talking about the bus infrastructure, that's where we're talking about. Services, we're talking about ensuring that our settlements have education, health, culture, welfare, recreation, services, and so forth and so forth. All the things that I said, in order for us to ensure that there's a holistic approach, these are the things that we need to be looking at. What are the other aspects of human settlements? Because those are not the physical. And sometimes we tend to focus on the physical and not think about what then how the physical impact on the other aspects of the well-being of individuals. This is your social aspect. How do we use our settlement to build social cohesion? How do we use our settlement to deal with issues around cultural and spiritual well-being of individuals? How do we deal with issues around the job market? Because we cannot have settlements where people have to travel kilometers and kilometers away if we do not have efficient public transport infrastructure. Issues around how do we then ensure that people have access also to finance? Because there are people that are not necessarily dependent on 100% from government, but they are dependent on government to ensure that there's access to finance. Then what about the environment? Do we still continue to have the same standards, take into consideration of the climate change, issues around the green building, issues around the issues, electricity that is not there. How do we deal with this? Do we have to go back and review the standard of the standards? So the general principles that we have in the development of the green paper is almost the same that we had in 1994. We do need to deal with issues around access. We have not fully dealt with access. Yes, we have in a way been able to provide access to over 15 million people in this country in terms of housing, but we still have to continue providing access. The question is, how do we then change the way that we are providing access to come up with new tools of how to provide access? Deal with equity issues. Integration, inclusion, social targeting, affordability issues, as I indicated earlier. So what then would be the focus of the Green Paper? As instead by the National Development Plan, we don't need to come up with much more bolder steps for development of sustainable settlements. Issues around overarching principles for social development, that's one of the issues that we need to be focusing on. Yes, there's SPLUMA, which is the Special Planning and Land Management Act, but then what does that mean in terms of human settlements? We need to ensure that we develop then the working principles in terms of special planning and human settlements. Also, as I indicated, the issues around the special patents, how do we deal with issues around special patents? And I think I have already made some proposals on what we need to do it, but we need to come up with further proposals. The current housing policy that we need to deal with and to ensure that we realize the constitutional rights. So we cannot move away completely from the housing policy, but we need to come up with different issues to deal with the housing policies because the constitution says enshrines the right to housing. So we do need, what the constitution doesn't say is how. So we need to deal with the how part of the right to housing. And so we also need to revise the housing finance regime, including ensuring that we build the capacity of the state so that the state itself is able to transform the current human settlement and the new ones that we're building are what we want human settlements to be. We can't continue to build settlements that are not efficient, that are not environmentally sensitive, so forth and so forth. We also have to make sure that we strengthen the comprehensive plan. There are various aspects of the comprehensive plan that we still have to put into the paper because it was a good plan. But the 10 years after its approval, we've been implementing it for 10 years, so it's also time for us to look back and see what works and what doesn't work and what are the aspects that need to be strengthened. So the policy blueprint will deal with the ideology, the theory, and the application. And so the major issue is about how do we sharpen the current existing instruments while coming up with new instruments. We also, because what we're lacking also in part is that we never come up, when we develop policy, it's usually outside of implementation and evaluation as I indicated. So the green paper will also deal with policy implementation issues. I say, what are the theory of implementation that we would have? What are the models for implementation? What is the capacity that we need to implement and the resources that we need to implement. Because just having a policy blueprint is not enough. And we've been criticized a lot about having very good policies, but those policies do not translate into implementation. So part of the development of the green paper will not only look at the actual policy which I call blueprint, we're also looking at policy implementation. What is it that we need for implementation? The model, the capacity, the resources, the theory of the implementation. And I've spoken about the evaluation. We also will have, also as part of the green paper development, look at what is it that we need to do to evaluate, what are issues around efficiency, effectiveness, and equity issues, and more, and other indicators that I have elaborated on later. So this is usually the policy cycle that you will have the green paper. And out of that green paper, as I indicated, it will form strategy for the development of sustainable management, which is 2050 strategy. And from then, then we'll have a policy and then a program, the rest programs. And then, as you all know, that currently what we have in terms of programs is encased into what we're calling the housing code. Maybe now we probably need to look at whether we review the housing code and have a human settlement code, or we have a human settlement code and housing code quite as distinct. But we have not made that decision yet, whether we do need both, or we need to run and subsume the housing code within the human settlement code. We usually then, we do need to have to revise the Housing Act, same issues that we need to be dealing with, whether we need to have a human settlement act and a housing act, or you have one act where issues around housing will be addressed within the human settlement. These are our basis for the development of the green paper. As you know, I'm not going to go through them, but these are our key policies since 1994, and this is what we're going to be using as our basis for the development of the green paper. This is what comprehensive, as I indicated to you, we would look at the strength of the comprehensive plan, which is what's saying that what we wanted to achieve at the time, 2004, was to accelerate housing delivery. We still want to do that. Hence, we have to do that. Maybe what we need to do now is to look at different models on acceleration of housing delivery. But that objective is still relevant. We need to improve the quality of housing product and environment to ensure asset creation. I think we still have to continue to do that. A single efficient formal housing market, in some way, we have been less successful in ensuring that happens. And this past years, we have put concrete steps in place to ensure that we achieve this, and we will continue to do that in the next 15 years up to 2030 to ensure that we have a still functional housing market. But even like, because the housing market currently is only favoring the higher middle and the higher income earners, it doesn't favor the lower and the low income earners. Restructuring and reintegrate human settlements, I think I did indicate what we need to be doing, but these are what we need to continue with, and probably think about what are the other things that we need to be looking at. So that is what we are currently busy debating and dealing with. There were other non-social transformation aspects of the comprehensive plan, which I think is relevant, because they took victory from the Constitution of creating a non-racial and inequitable society, and so using housing, deliverance, sexuality, poverty and job creation, which is exactly also what the National Development Plan is saying, promoting social cohesion and so forth and so on. The current legislation, as I indicated, establishes a basis for all policies and programs, including related legislation. So that's what we will have to review. And we need to review other pieces of legislation that came as a result of the Housing Act. In the development of the Green Paper, we also have an understanding, we need to have an understanding that the cities, towns, they function, those are geographical spaces that initially function. So these are the things that we are looking at in terms of the development, that we're not looking at the settlement now outside of where they are. Because I think that's our major witnesses before, that sometimes we tend to focus on settlements and not look at what is the relationship between the settlement and where that settlement is, and how then can we ensure that there's better coordination and collaboration with the better sector. We also have to deal with this one, which I have indicated earlier on, what we need to be dealing with in terms of social plan. I'm not going to go into detail about that one, but it's about, it's part of what I said about diagnosis, good diagnosis, because if we come up with an instrument without ensuring that we are diagnosing our problems correctly, then we will miss diagnosis. Issues, we need to deal with issues around urbanization. 50% of South African population is in urban areas, that we all know. And we know that all the people that are studying trends are saying that 70% by 2030 will be in urban areas. But we also know that a large percentage of South African population is young, is under the age of 34. So what does it mean in terms of human settlements? It means then that we need to have different tools now if you have younger population. We have to deal with issues around circular migration. How do we deal with issues around provision of adequate housing when there's this circular migration? Issues around child, I think there's a lot that has been said in the past 20 years. If you look at the 2-year review, you also look at the diagnostic report from the National Development Plan, it said a lot around what are the challenges around child. As I indicated, 60% of the South African population is under the age of 34. Those are our contextual realities. And we also know that the average income is about 103,000 rand a year. What it means also is that some of these people would not be able to depend, they would depend on government basically for some form of intervention. We also know that there's increasing demand. Over 2 million households in the urban areas alone have substandard housing conditions, which is what we call informal settlements, in sheds and daycare and so forth and so forth. And also already 2 million and what are subbing are solely dependent on the intervention of the state for housing. And also what we also know that in the past 5 years, provision for housing has declined. Those are our conditional realities. And how do we then use the Green Paper to ensure that the 2030-year plan that we have ensure that we turn the corner around all those conditional realities or address them. We do know the achievements. I will not deal with, but these are some of our achievements in the past 2 years. And we will not throw the baby with the bathwater. We will build on those achievements of, for example, we tested the mega project, and we now have to ensure that we continue to implementing those mega projects. So what else is contributing towards the shaping of the human settlements community? As I indicated, the National Development Plan, the Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Act. I had already mentioned that, but I have not mentioned that there's an integrated urban development framework, which is also going to influence how that and shaping the human settlements paper. There's also a Green Paper on rural development, which we are all taking into consideration in the development of that paper. The development of the Prendipa will be responding to the national development then, the constitutional mandate of the Department of Human Settlements, and also ensuring that we develop sustainable human settlements, and also looking at the application of police in the past 20 years. We remember, I think you all know that there were 6 cases that were presented to you, that we conceptualization phase. So we are ending the conceptualization phase. We are now starting between phase 2 and phase 3, which is the development and the consultative phase. And then we will then deal with it, because consultation is not a step-by-step process. So it's a loop that we're going to go back every phase, go back to consultation and then revise, go develop, go back and consult and then revise. So those are the phases. So right now we are between phase 1, 2 and 3. Lastly, I would like to say to you, taking now a lesson from the National Development Plan that says there are no quick fixes for transforming the functioning of human settlements and the working of the space economy. However, it says that both measures taken over a sustainable period could change the trajectory of social development and could mean considerable gains for ordinary citizens and for the national economy. This process must start now. That's why already in the current MSF we already started, so that we can stop and reverse the dysfunctional systems that have continued since 1994. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sokobo, on that progress report on the development and paper on human settlements. Just before I open to my colleagues for blankets and questions, maybe quickly, Dr. Sokobo, when do you envisage this process to be finished? Just so that
we can see. We're hoping that not the current financial year, but just next year we'll be finishing it off. It might not be March 2015. It might be probably towards the end of 2015.
So you think probably the second quarter of 2015. Thank you very much. That's the presentation, colleagues, and the progress made on the Green Paper on Human Settlements. Let me hear a comment, clarity, questions. Honorable Tole, Honorable Ghana, can I take Honorable Baker, can I take those and just stand here? I'll come back.
Thank you, Chairperson. And we must appreciate the presentation from the department. But the person, there's something that I want to find out from the department. How long does it take to develop a green paper and a white paper? Because if you check this, the human settlement changed in 2009. Now we are in 2014. They are still talking about the development of green paper. How long does it take? Do they have the capacity? Because they have to inform us about the capacity. But sometimes you can say they are slow but they don't have the capacity. Because if you check now, they are talking about BMG. BMG is a new policy, not a new policy. It started in 2004. Now they are trying to implement something that was supposed to be done a long time ago. They are talking about LDP, which is just a policy, just last year policy, which is now trying the whole process of developing the policies and the act of the government. And I have a contention present because we have running with the human settlements in 2009 until now. It means we didn't use the policy, we were just using the housing act. Even now it means you are using the housing act. It means if somebody can arrange that in court, you can win in court. That's my contention present. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Story. Honorable Kana, let me reserve my comment, Honorable Story, to what you have just said. Honorable Kana.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks for the presentation and the update of where the process is. I think, let me just say that I like what I'm hearing, but I've in many instances I've liked what I've heard or what I've read about the policies that the department does. As you might know, that in many aspects I do agree with the PNG and the NDP aspect of human settlement, but the big problem is always on the implementation side. And you touched briefly on the capacity and resource aspect that you need to look at. I think that needs to be the bigger focus. If people are to transform human settlement, we need to take the capacity, because coming up with a policy and then there just no people to implement. And many of us might remember or recall when the late Minister of Education, Kadamal, came with the OPE. The police were there, but the teachers that were in the system, they were not literally trained to deliver that particular system. And we had to go back after some serious damage that was done to that to education, and we go back to where we were before OBE. And for me, I just want to check, whilst we have been developing this police, what are we doing in terms of capacitating the people that have to implement it? Because it doesn't help for the department to spend so much time, effort to develop a policy, only to find that the people that have to implement it, they are still thinking they see the housing development as a way for them to get to get tenders rather than improving the lives of our people. You mentioned the issue of urbanization, which I do accept. But one of the reasons that people do move to the urban centers is because of economic opportunities. And more, because we are actually failing, I think, as a nation, all of us, regardless of where you come from, to actually build communities. But in a way that people in Limpopo, where I come from, might not necessarily have to go to Johannesburg or to Cape Town. If they want to live in urban centers, if we create an urban center in Limpopo, then the pressures that are experienced by Johannesburg, Cape Town, and to a lesser extent Pretoria, will not be there. But at this rate, I'm worried, you know, that we'll continue having this thing, the informal settlements, because people come in, they don't have the means to stay in formal dwellings, they go into informal settlements. And on page, that slide number 12, and this speaks to the slide that of urbanization. One, you do agree that we need to move. The focus for the last 20 years has been on the shelter aspect, and very little is done in terms of the services. You know, infrastructure, we do try, but the services aspect, especially in informal settlement, is still lacking. And I would think that to address the challenges that we have around informal settlement, the start point is improving the quality of life, because that's what the intention is. It's about putting the services there, you know, the recreational centers, education facilities, health facilities there. And maybe as a proposal for the immediate, because by 2015, you say by 2030 there will be 30%, now we are at 60%. By 2016 might be at around 63-64%. And we're not doing much to actually improve the settlements, because it might not be about building a house. I think we must equip our people to build their own houses, but we need to provide the services so that they can feel that they are part of a community. So if we can deal with the capacity and also the services, I think we'll go somewhere. Because without them, rather I agree with the police, and 90% I agree, but then 3 years down the line, we'll come back and say, no, but people still continue to think in the apartheid way, we're building houses far away from the epicenter. So let's start changing the people that have to implement this policy. If the people don't exist in the department now, maybe the opportunity is to go and find them, go to universities and technical ones to find them, and by the time the policy is implemented, they are already in the system and they know what is expected of them, because it can't be 10 years later and say, no, we still have been capacity issues to implement the policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I've got some serious concerns. This is a draft document which will determine the human settlement policy. But my main concern is that we are already building houses and establishing development, but now we're going to develop the policy. To me, it's a bit like, to use an appropriate analogy, we already started building the house, now we're deciding what it's going to look like, and then we're going to go back to the drawing board and do it again and have the discussion with the architect. It's really, we've got the whole process messed up. We're in a consultation process, but we haven't quite decided who we're going to consult yet. We're still deciding, but I'm concerned. I think I appreciate the presentation, and I think the intention is really noble, but why has it taken so long for us to get to this process? Why are we only here now? We should have been here 18 years ago. This is way, way overdue. Way overdue. As Honourable Sitoli said, we shouldn't have had to wait for NP and BNG and all these things. This should have been the initiator. And with regards to my concern then comes to the developments we have on the go now, the houses we're already building and the developments that we already have planned. How are we going to ensure that what we are doing now is in keeping or helps us to enforce what our 2030 vision, our longer vision is, so that we don't run the risk of financial loss firstly. We are building things according to our special appointed plans, which we need to kick out like as in yesterday, but we're still going according to those programs. So how are you going to ensure that we're not wasting our time and wasting our money and that we get proper productivity? With no disrespect, you said there are no quick fixes. I'd like to challenge the department to find the quick fixes. This is a program that needs to be fast-tracked. We cannot wait another 30, 40 years. We need to find those quick fixes in order to fast-track the process as soon as possible. We know, as we have discussed previously, the demand for housing and human settlements is growing daily, with informal settlements popping up all over the show. So we cannot afford to waste any more time. We need quick fixes now, not in 30 years' time. Thank you.
Just so that I can understand you, Anna, because I'm saying we shouldn't have built any houses until there was the project.
No, I'm not saying. I'm saying how are we going to ensure that what we are doing now is in keeping with that we are not, we're certainly not stopping the process.
No, thank you very much. As I welcome the Director General of the Department, Mr. Tamanizos, you are welcome to
thank you.
I'm not allowing you to talk yet. I'm just welcoming you in the meeting.
Thank you, Chairperson. On page 4, where you are dealing with the transformation of the human settlement, on intermediate outcome A, I see a policy shift from the housing opportunities, adequate housing, improved quality living environment, and there's no mention of housing opportunities. My fear is that if we leave out opportunities, it means the people that only need a set of sites, we are closing the doors of them, because those people can afford to build a house. They just need the government to assist them with a piece of land with services. And the housing opportunities had covered that. The second one, Chairperson, is on page 6. And I want to link page 6 with the page 12 that talks about the spatial planning. On your holistic approach, if you include them, the services, water, sanitation, electricity, with housing delivery in that section, in that box, it interprets that the other departments are not going to take responsibility, as the others in those sections we have mentioned them. The other departments that are responsible for infrastructure, for housing development or housing opportunity development, or human settlement development, shall I say human settlement development. The human settlements coordinate everybody that is supposed to provide services within the human settlements, but not moving away the responsibility of the Department of Transport to provide, and the roads department to provide access route, or to provide bus route and taxi route. And your water and sanitation, I would prefer water and sanitation as a department that needs to provide bulk infrastructure for human settlements to have its own cycling course. And also your electricity, also the energy department that is responsible for the provision of electricity must also have its own separate, because we are only coordinating, we are not taking away their responsibilities. We might be responsible for the inner circulation in terms of the provision of those inside the house, but they are primary people that must provide infrastructure for those. And then, Chairperson, I need to the I think it's for me the one is on the going back to page nine. That your development is slightly in relation to policies and act. And I would propose that we have a human settlement act that incorporates housing legislation, so that we cover what Honorable Tony was talking about in relation to your BHG that will incorporate, because the BHG is there, all of those policies that have been in existence, and that the Department of Housing and now Human Settlement were implementing to create a housing opportunities and thereafter human settlement. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Nanga. I thought, Honorable Nanga, that's what this green paper is seeking to do. To integrate all those policies that are existing. Okay. All right.
I'm supporting that.
Honorable Meme?
Chairperson, many of my points are taken already by my colleague.
Take them back.
I'd love to do that. But maybe, Chair, I think it's the fact that this policy is helping us a lot. But I think, colleague, I think we were operating in a vacuum, might want to reconsider, because the Supreme Law of the country directs the activities of government, which is the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. So, and from there, we have the Act. I think this green paper, it is addressing, because as you move, you always evaluate, you always assess. As you assess weaknesses, you want to strengthen what you want to cover. I think, although page 6 slides there try to include a lot of areas, but the fighting legacy of apartheid is still with us. We are still trapped in the apartheid mode in terms of special framework, what my colleague has already identified. For example, we are still failing to integrate our communities. I think you have mentioned that in this green paper, so there's something that you are focusing to address. Maybe, although page 11, covered my area, but I want to put emphasis because remember Ghana also put that point, the rural areas. You see, it is the areas where we were born from. So it's important that we don't forget where we're from. So we must also not force everybody to migrate to urban centers, because there's already a lot of congestion. So I think we must indeed focus on infrastructure development, so which means we must coordinate departments in the way WIP was indicating. I think that the policy is covering a lot of our concerns, is really helping. But the more we go to stakeholders, which we know, our stakeholders are known. I don't think the member was fine when you say we don't know who to, maybe the department doesn't know, because we all know the stakeholders. We start in wards, you see. So we go to district, go to places, go to. So I think it was. So I think we must appreciate the department. But maybe they appealed the time. Well, I think they must speed it a little bit. So it shouldn't take long, because everything else is new. So we can speed it up a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mendez. Maybe just before I hand over to the department to respond, maybe if they respond, they must also clarify, because my understanding was that the housing codes was also in the process of being reviewed. And in the presentation, there was a question of the housing code probably being subsumed into the human development code, which maybe that can be verified as they respond. One of the interesting questions that I'm not going to ask, probably that you must think about, is the fact that as you were presenting, you know, you said 60% of the population is under 24 years old. Very interesting. Very interesting. I'm not going to go further. That's very interesting. I leave it there. Over to the department.
Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, I want to apologize for coming late to your meeting. The flight was delayed by 40 minutes under normal circumstances. I hate to be late for a meeting, and profusely apologize for circumstances which were beyond my control and I came late to your meeting. I want to thank my team for having kick-started the process together with the Honorable Chairperson. So I won't comment much. I will allow them to comment more. But I think there is one issue that I would like to give a perspective to. Is the one that relates to the development of human settlement strategy, which I think is part of this process. Honorable Soda made a reference to Binji in 2004. That was a lot of thinking that has gone into that process. And that was translated practically in 2009. And the department was then renamed to Department of Human Settlements, not from a Department of Housing. I think we must also appreciate that fundamental shift. That was beginning to say development of human settlements or housing in South Africa will never be the same again. And that fundamentally changed the manner in which we do business within human settlements. I think it's important to mention, Honorable Chair and members, that since the introduction of human settlements, we have not done business at human settlements as usual. We have changed our approach, we have changed our strategy, we have incorporated fundamental elements of the BNG policy from 2009. In fact, we even changed the structure of the National Department and also influenced the Department of Human Settlements to follow a new strategic direction of doing things. From 2009, when we became Department of Human Settlements, we've been looking into our responsibility and mandate for fundamentally different. So we've not been waiting for the process of a green paper and the Human Settlement Act to be in place before we can put things into practice. What you are trying to do is to formalize our thinking into an act rather than to be policy statements. Once a policy statement is made by the president of the country and changed the mandate, we are not waiting for a particular process to be undertaken. We begin to gear ourselves into the implementation mode and change the methodology of how we do things. We've been doing that in the last 4 years. If you're to visit projects that have been undertaken within the human settlement space from 2010 up until now, you'll see a fundamental shift that has happened, beginning to accommodate elements of NG. Practical projects will be Cornubia, will be Palale, will be rental and social accommodation in Eastern Cape, will be inner city building revitalization projects. You'll see a fundamental shift from how we have been building. That's why one of the key components has been the issue of land, because you begin to say you can no longer put people in a remote area from where fundamental social services, as the member was saying, are in existence. And site 11 is trying to give that practical perspective that the human settlements act must then reflect this in its context, not the housing act, because the housing act did not deal specifically with these areas. It's a matter of translating this practical approach into a process of legislation and give it a much more tighter process, something that we can hold on to say this is what human settlement is all about, legislatively speaking. But in terms of policy change, in terms of our approach, in terms of delivering on the ground, we are actually operating within what we're proposing as we speak. It's an approach we have adopted. Even the policy instruments that we have been revisiting, like financing schemes, like Rental Social Act, which we have just revisited as the department, are talking into all these things. So what we're doing here is to give effect into a legislative process so that we can have something as a department that we can rely on as we implement our policy new framework that we work on. That's the perspective within which we've been doing this exercise. This is probably, Honorable Chairperson, the last leg of that process leading into the 2010 and 2050 vision. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Thank you,
DJ.
Specific questions, Dr. Okoko and Mr. Dangane.
It's the first one of the done by Mr. Shangane. I think the honorable spoke about this does not necessarily represent that holistic approach does not represent department per se. It says this is what we need in terms of settlement per se. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about coordination. The approach that we're going to be adopting is to ensure that we're coordinating and ensure that each and every department takes its own responsibility as part of the development of human settlements. The issues around the Human Settlements Act vis-a-vis the Housing Act, I think the DJ has already responded to that we will have an umbrella Human Settlements Act, and maybe some aspects of what is currently in the Housing Code, in the Housing Act, will be part of the Human Settlements Act. The same thing as with the Housing Code. Some aspects of what is the Housing Code will be part of the Human Settlements Act to deal with issues around, for example, infrastructure, services, and so forth, which are some, it's not our responsibility, but as a coordinating department, then make sure that the other departments are taking that responsibility. The speeding up process, I think, will be judged by Mr. Sharman. The issue of transforming human settlements, I think DJ is right to say that that has been part of the process since the adoption of the DJ. But I think that what we need to ensure now with the adoption of the group is to expand our program to ensure that it's not an isolated project. It's the way that we do things. Already I have indicated that in the current 5 years, if you look at the back at the outcomes that we said we wanted to achieve, if these outcomes, they are not necessary, it's still adequate housing and improved quality environment. The opportunities are subsumed within that. When we are unpacked that, then we talk about opportunities for different income bands. How the housing opportunities. So this is not an outcome. What we want to achieve is that every South African should be living in adequate housing, and also the live also in quality environment. That's what we want to achieve. Then how we're doing that to provide housing opportunities. So how the opportunity to help us, what is the adequate help? Also, issues around functionally equitable property market is what we want to achieve. How we want to deal with that, we make sure that, for example, you have your financing subsidy program, you deal with the gas market to ensure that there's enough stock in terms of the teachers, the policemen, and all the other people that are part of the gas market. I would also like to highlight that in the current budget, which is 2014-2019, what would be inclusive in terms of what we want to achieve is we have already put that in place. So there is a synergy between what the 5 years want to achieve and what will actually be in the country. So it lays a foundation to what will be in the country. And also take into consideration all those lessons that we have learned through the implementation of the BNG and also the pre-BNG. So there's not going to be kind of a disruptive aspect of it, of saying that even the indicators when we are the assessment projects are based on what we consider as quality living environment and what we consider as sustainable assessment. But what we probably need to do is to ensure that in terms of implementation, we are much more stronger, and also in terms of monitoring, we ensure that what we implement, what is on paper, translates to implementation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think most of the questions have been covered by the DG and Dr. Sokol. I think there's a clear message that we need to expedite the process. I think that message is heard, and I think we will try and come up with a revised process now on how the process is going to be finalized. So we will review and look at our timelines. There's a question about the capacity of the department and the implementing agencies to implement this process and these policies. I think we started that process with the bulk of what you have here, the bulk of housing with human settlements programs are implemented through partnership. If you look at them, the reason why we're talking about mega projects, it is because the actual developers of these programs are in the private sector, the big development companies. If you implement a mixed type of development with social housing, with CRU, with BNG, with affordable housing, that's where we're going. We want to integrate the typology of the products, but also indirectly the beneficiaries as well. You will need more capacitated developers to help you to develop those settlements at the project level. At the program level, you need strong program and project managers within the department to help you to manage and package these projects. And I think that exercise has already been started by the accounting officer. With the HODs and policies. We need to review the way we do business. I think some of the departments were formed when we were still dealing with housing issues. So one has to think about the recruitment strategy going forward, because we need more program and project managers to implement these policies. I think for policy formulation expertise and research expertise, I think that capacity does exist. Within the department, I think Dr. Sokopo has been in the business of policy formulation in the department for some time. We have a good team of policy formulators within the department, but it's on the implementation side where you have more concerns. And I think we've started the approach of gearing our recruitment strategy towards getting program experience, program and project managers. I think this is what informed the DG to come up with the program and project management unit in the department in the first place. You'll recall that we didn't have this kind of structure in the department before 2012. The accounting officer introduced the program and project management unit, so it's to make sure that we focus more on implementation. The question about whether we're working in a vacuum, I think that one was answered. We're not working in a vacuum at all. You recall we started with the Housing Act. We had the Benji Police in 2004. We reviewed the Housing Code in 2009. If you look at some of the policies, progress in the housing code. They were all reviewed in 2009. We introduced the IRDP, which is the Integrated Residential Development Program, in 2009, which is more about integration. I think all what we're trying to do now is to take stock of what has happened over the last, I would say, 10 years, and make sure that we tighten up. I think that's the language that Dr. Sloan is using. We tighten up some of the policy gaps. That's what we find there. We're talking about housing, but we are already implementing human settlements programs. Mm. So we need to move from Housing Act to Human Settlements Act. But before you get into the legislation, we have to master the processes of the green paper, the white paper, that will inform the end state, in this case the end state will be the Human Settlements Act. I think the Minister has made this point explicitly already, that we're running slightly behind, and I think we've echoed the same point, that we're running behind with this program, with this policy review. We should have done it at least maybe a year ago or two. There's a question about immigration. I think Dr. Kokwa attempted that question. The good news is that the Big Five built environment departments have started working together. I think there is what we call an IMC on infrastructure, basic infrastructure, which is led by COGDA. Transport, human settlements, even rural development, and rural development, they're participating in that meeting. These five departments, water and sanitation is there as well, transport. So these five built environment departments, if you look at their budget over the next NGF period, they have a combined budget of more than 500 billion rands. And these are all the departments that have to implement elements of human settlements. So that process of integrating their work has started in the MTEC process, budgeting for this MTEC. We've discussed those issues with Treasury is also participating in the IMC on basic services or basic infrastructure. So we have no option but to coordinate all of these activities in a built environment. I think that is the point that you were trying to explain. The question of capacity, I think, yes, we acknowledge that there are some capacity concerns, but the initiative that is starting now to partner with all the built environment plans, the institutions, county institutions, HDA's mandate has been reviewed. HDA was formed to assist the government to package and assist in implementing some of the human settlements projects on the N2DP program. The N2DP is an implementing agent. So we're not only looking at what is within the department, we're also looking at our partners outside the department, HDA being one of them. We have a number of built environment institutions as well that are assisting us. The Association for Developers, they have signed and have pledged their support as well to the department. And if you look at the World in the Upper initiative, what the minister was trying to do is to garner support from a number of other players to assist us to implement this program and to beef up the capacity of the sector, and not just the capacity of the state, but the capacity of the sector to implement this program, whether it's private initiated programs or public initiated programs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DG and the officials from the department. You would appreciate the fact that the clarity and questions asked by the honorable members actually not because they don't appreciate the progress that we've made, but they are just expressing the urgency of what needs to be done. We note the fact that in terms of the phases that we have outlined, that you are moving in between the first three, because between phase 1, 2, and 3, and we hope that the members of the youth move faster. I think Honorable Baker even put it even more clear and said 5 quick fixes. Let's try and do this thing more faster. We are all in agreement that there is a need for this, and all that you are saying, we just want to make sure that it is done with the quickest speed. Thank you very much for the progress report. We appreciate. We will be calling you back very soon to hear. Have have you moved out of the first two phases? Where are you and what happened? The portfolio committee appreciates this report. We now move to the second report from the department. Maybe just before that, just a 2 minute comfort break, honorable members. I don't want my members to fall asleep. 2 minutes comfort break. I know that everybody wants this to happen. Yeah.
You don't need to come to worship.
Thank you, Honorable Members and officials. Can we step time to take our seats? Thank you, honorable members and officials. We move you now to the second item, which is the presentation on the Mediterranean Standard Report on wine. As we have already said, this report was already tabled in the House of Parliament, and we debated it, and then we agreed that the report must be referred to the committee. That's where we are now. So the DG of the department is going to present the report. We all have copies of the report, I hope. Okay. Can we then start straight away? Over to you, Mr. Zulu.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, and thanks for inviting us to present our report that relates to the Monday vision, which is the report that was put together by the ministerial inquiry team that was established by the minister. Our report will provide background and also what was the purpose of the inquiry, and will also reflect briefly on the terms of reference, and also importantly the methodology that we adopted when we were doing this work. Of course, reflect on some of the limitations that the inquiry committee had at its disposal, and most importantly, to reflect on what findings were then established and what recommendations can be considered by the Honorable Minister and committee in relation to what transpired. Yeah, as you know, that it's a very comprehensive report, and I'm glad that honorable members have the copy. We have condensed this into a very brief presentation of only 32 slides, but most of the information, should there be any reason, is also on the report with about 238 pages. Just to focus on the background chair quickly, on the 2nd and 3rd of June, we were made aware that occupants of Nom Za Motran were evicted from the land which they were residing in, and obviously this eviction resulted in a large number of families who were rendered homeless and subsequently accommodated in the Nom Za Motran community hall. The land in question is owned by the South African National Road Agency Limited, and it is also mentioned that on the 4th of June 2014, we were then asked through the Office of the Minister to establish the Land Minister Inquiry Committee, which was then established on day. As most of the honorable members will know, these are the members that were appointed, chaired by the Advocate Politician, Madam Tambula, Madam Ramosamikoti, Madam Sosibo, Mr. Steen, Madam Van Veek, and Mrs. Kuluku later resigned in July. These are the members that were then tasked with the responsibility of doing some inquiry on this eviction that I've just made reference to. What was then the purpose of this inquiry was to simply establish that even though we know that at our disposal we have different pieces of legislation and policies, which normally governs the process where people are evicted and left homeless or despondent, but evictions they continue to exist. And this has necessitated then the need to find another solution to establish exactly what could have been the reasons for this and what lessons or better management of such evictions that they continue to happen in our country we can deal with, and also interrogate some of the reasons for what can be presumed as legislative loopholes and policy gaps or failures in implementation of some of our policies and legislation. Furthermore, our Honourable Minister wanted to establish the real causes of the land occupation which resulted into eviction and all other legal processes that have been followed leading to the ultimate evictions of this community. The directive was quite clear that the outcomes of this inquiry will be as informative as possible for the contributors to find humane and lasting solutions to the housing challenges in our country. As honourable members, you also be aware that when these evictions were happening, they happened during the very bad season. It was happening on a very cold day, and the minister was concerned that surely there should be some ways and means to do such evictions even if they are permitted in a much more humane way. We went further to assist the inquiry team by establishing terms of reference in which they can perform their function, and the terms of reference were then developed, which basically provided a mandate for the inquiry to take place. Among the terms of reference, we put it very clearly that they will have to investigate all the circumstances under which the evictions took place and the issue of the evictions, including the facts leading to the application for an obtaining of the court order on 24 January 2014 by SANLO. The execution of the said court order by SANLO, the role of the relevant sheriff for the jurisdiction of Cape Town, the roles of the law enforcement officials of the South African Police Services, the Cape Town Metro Police, and any other official of the national, provincial and local government involved, and any other person. Further, to establish the identity of the members of the informal settlement community of Ulwandle and how the community came to be on the land in question when there is a waiting list for the provision of housing in terms of government programs generally. And also to report to the Honourable Minister of Human Settlements the investigations and the findings, and obviously to make the necessary recommendations for the Minister to consider. Originally, it was suggested that this was a special assignment and therefore it should last for a period of 2 months. But there was so much work that needed to be done, and the Honourable Minister, together with the department, considered an extension, and the assignment then was for a period of 3 months. There were some grounds for the inquiry, and some of the grounds are informed by various constitutional decisions that have been made in the past on this area of evictions in our country generally, but also the prevention of illegal eviction from an Unlawful Occupation Land Act 1998 Act, which is one of the relevant acts that relate to issues of evictions, but also the issue of emergency housing policy which currently exists within our human settlement sector, and also the Intergovernmental Relations Framework Act, which is a very relevant act for issues of evictions because local government gets involved, provincial departments of human settlement and courts are getting involved, so at the national departments of the health centers get involved. So Intergovernmental Relations Act becomes a very relevant piece of legislation to deal with matters of this nature. It's within that context that we developed a methodology informed by the grounds I've made reference to, whereby different relevant parties or stakeholders were invited to make written submissions or comments relevant to the subject matter, and this was mandated to the Ministerial Inquiry Committee. The request was communicated, having identified various stakeholders that we thought were relevant to provide necessary information, and different forms of communication were then established, including newspapers, advertisements, television and radio statements, and talk shows, as well as other communication methods, and
and some of the stakeholders received requests through writing directly to them and inviting them to make their submissions or oral submissions to the committee. The Ministerial Inquiry conducted all its public hearings except for the committee that was affected. The approach was different, whereby information of the affected community was done through statement taking at the hall where they were temporarily kept until such time that the matter is resolved. And some of the statements, I must indicate, Honorable Chair, that these were not some statements, as we all understand that the nature of the inquiry was not of a judicial sense. But it was question is just to aid the inquiry to be able to get into the bottom of the issue through its investigation. Some public hearings were also held at the hall to get a sense of the affected committee members how the whole situation has erupted. Here I've made reference to the fact that an inquiry of this nature had its own limitations, and as we all understand that it was happening with other pieces of legislation and policy guidance at our disposal. It was not of a judicial sense, so some of the powers that were vested in the committee were very limited, as this was not necessarily a commission. So even to subpoena witnesses could not be one of the approaches to be used to form part of the methodology of gathering information to make sure that some information is received and testimony is submitted to some form of an oath. As a result, some of the time frames for the inquiry were a challenge, especially the way it was beginning to be difficult to gather information without subpoena, without using the subpoena approach to get information from relevant stakeholders. Some of the stakeholders that were considered to be relevant for this inquiry and who were also invited to make submissions in different formats for the South African Road Agency, SANRA, South African Board of Sheriffs, South African Police Service, in the Western Cape in particular, the City of Cape Town, Western Cape Provincial Department of Human Settlements, and the National Department of Human Settlements. You'll find the detail of their submissions in the report here. I decided not to go into detail of this, but some of the submissions were received from the following stakeholders: SANRA, SAPS, Sand Sheriff, City of Cape Town, Western Cape, Department of Human Settlements, the National Department of Human Settlements, and the Housing Development Agency, which was tasked with the responsibility of assisting with the administration of the entire exercise, together with different officials from the National Office of Human Settlements Department. Amongst the submissions that were received, Chair, White Council on the of Ward 85, Sipana People's Rights Movement made a submission, Access to Justice of Southern Africa, representatives of the Methodist Church, Somashango Social Investment Project, African National Congress, Western Cape, Tim Fleck, member of the public, Mr. Colin Aronson, member of the public, and some of the strong residents also made their submissions. Some of the lens we used to analyze submissions as part of the management of the submissions to identify the issues that are raised, synthesizing content of the issues and determining recommendations made in the submissions. Furthermore, Honorable Chairperson, an assessment was made on how these submissions responded to the terms of reference to make sure that the committee was within the context of its terms of reference. The full extent of the identity of the elected committee cannot be established due to the dynamics that were on the ground. And also the community, it was indicated that it first moved into the site as part of the findings in December 2013. Mm-hmm. Although it's common knowledge, it's been a number that has been used, that 800 people were evicted, but also this number could not be easily scientifically verified to make sure that it talks to the exact figure. The number of flats demolished also could not be easily determined because of the conditions on the ground and the methods that were being used. Our understanding, Chair, from the process is that the issue of evictions on the land in question relates that initially the evictions took place in February 2014, but started to rebuild on the same land a few weeks later. The land was not secured even after the February evictions, and there were no notices placed on the site. It's alleged that during the evictions in February, no prior notice was given. As a result, some people were not present on the day. When February eviction took place, some people indicated that they built the structures but had not yet moved in. Although the community was not informed about the evictions, they reported that they have seen someone entering the structures before the eviction occurred in February. One of the fundamental questions was how the community came to be on the land in question. It is alleged that the people evicted on the 3rd of June 2014 were peculiars in Nomzamo, Asanda village, Zolandwande, Fahabitki, and other surrounding informal settlements, and they named the new settlement Sianyanzela. They hated Sianyanzela, saying, I can't translate it in English. It is the Sianyanzela name. That could give you a context of the entire situation as well. They started the move to the settlement because they could not afford to pay high rentals, some of the findings indicate. Some of them indicated the challenge of unemployment and overcrowding, and others related to family problems. The majority, though, indicated that they saw others building, and then they decided just to do likewise. Only a small percentage had applied for permanent housing subsidy and are thus on the waiting list for assistance in terms of human settlements. Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, it is further alleged that during the evictions in June, the committee did not receive any prior notice. There was no communication about the evictions. As a result, panic and chaos ensued. On the days of the eviction, there was a pandemonium caused by the throwing of stones, petrol bombs by the community, and shooting of tear gas and rubber bullets by the police. The community was therefore not able to remove their belongings. As a result, some they lost everything that they had at their disposal. On 2nd June, the community slept in the open as they had nowhere to go. Honorable Chairperson, to go straight to some of the core findings, it is indicated that the land was unlawfully occupied during two phases, namely prior to the evictions on 3 February 2014 and during the period between the February and June 2014 evictions. The court order was therefore obtained to prevent the imminent invasion of the land during January. It's a very important statement that I'm making on that particular point, and I will repeat that the court order was obtained to prevent the imminent invasion of the land during June 2014. The court order was then utilized by SEMRAL to effect the evictions and to regain control of the land on the 3rd February 2014. However, it is alleged that SEMRAL failed to take effective steps to retain control of the land, resulting in it being reoccupied. Some of the normal steps that the landowner would be expected to put in place is to make sure that the fencing of the property that is under question, or to place necessary security in the form of guards or any form of security to do that, or to utilize the land for what is intended for, or to find a way to use the land by any other interested parties. These are some of the steps that normal landowners are expected in terms of the law and policy to subject themselves to avoid the situation from escalating as it had happened. The inquiry has concluded that the court order of the 24th June 2014 did not authorize SEMRAL to effect an eviction of the occupiers of the land. The relief granted to SEMRAL by the court was limited to preventing the invasion of the land. The court application was on an interim interdict and an eviction order in terms of the prevention of illegal evasion from an unlawful occupation of land Act 19 of 1998, which is normally known as PI Act. The court order chair did not authorize the removal of any persons or structures from the land on 2nd and 3rd June 2014.
the evictions on 2nd and 3rd of June 2014 not having been authorized by court order, therefore can be defined as having been illegal. The inquiry concluded that entities such as Sandal, the Sheriff of Town, the South African Police Service, and the City of Cape Town and its law enforcement agencies that were involved in effecting the evictions on 2nd and 3rd of June 2014 acted irregularly, in that the evictions were never authorized by a court order or by a proper court order. People were treated with disrespect and indignity, where their belongings were destroyed without any record. Chair, we have made specific reference to court findings. Obviously, part of the terms of reference for the inquiry was to then make specific recommendations that can be considered by the Minister, obviously, and the government at large. Some of the recommendations is that experts must be invited to do some research on outcomes of mass evictions and illegal occupation of land, which is normally a general trend in our country. Share some of their best practices in managing mass evictions. Identify if any policy legal loopholes and shortcomings in our current policy arrangement. Identify problems with current practice. Provide recommendations on appropriate responses to the identified challenges. Some of the experts that exist in our midst, in our country and internationally, have been identified. The list is very long, but we have just highlighted some of those that could assist in assisting the recommendations at our disposal. The Human Rights Commission, which has been very active in this area, National Association of Democratic Lawyers and other Lawyers for Human Rights, Community Law Center, University of Western Cape, Social Economic Rights Institute, South African Czech Dwellers International Alliance. It is further recommended that there might be a need to look into the possible amendment of the Prevention of Illegal Eviction from an Unlawful Occupation Act and see if there are no provisions that need tightening or review. That organs of state should refrain from using land invasion in tactics as de facto eviction orders, which in this case it does appear. That's how it happened. Also, landowners must proactively identify and secure their property or vacant land so as to discourage the possible invasions thereof. In carrying out an eviction order, the sheriff responsible must ensure proper recording and safekeeping of property. What is important on this point, Chair, is that the SAPS, when it's asked to do such a responsibility, the fundamental principle must be to protect all parties, all stakeholders, including the property of the illegal occupiers of a particular piece of land. And that the police as well government should develop an early warning system, tracking and monitoring mechanisms on evictions across the country. Again, that brings back the very same element I spoke about of our intergovernmental framework act that could be used effectively on matters of this nature, as this is becoming a common trend. That norms on evictions appear to be a microcosm of the situation prevailing in many parts of the country. It's apparent that there is a need for concerted intervention to address the situation of the unlawful invasion of land and the dire consequences that often accompany the steps taken to address such invasions. Chair, these are the recommendations. As I've indicated earlier on, this is a very comprehensive report, which has got 238 pages. We have provided you with an executive summary through the presentation of only 32 slides. So there's more meat in the comprehensive report than the presentation. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zulu. The meat that he's talking about is this one. The bones that he's talking about. Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Zulu. That's the report of the Lanley Vision Inquiry tables before you with clear recommendations.
Chair, Honorable Chair, with your permission, we have the advisor in the office of the Minister, who is also a legal authority by training. I'm not sure if you want to add something particularly because this is the report for the Minister.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, DJ. Before, I'm sure the team, is there anything that you want to add, Dr. Melan? No, thank you very much. I think from the official side, there's no more addition. There's the report in front of you, honorable members. Can I hear comments? Yep. I know, honorable Tole. I'll note honorable Tole, I'll note honorable Memezi, I'll note honorable Ghana. Can we push off this phone? Which is, you know, we all have them, actually. It's just that our are very off and very disciplined, but otherwise all of us report them. Honorable Bam Gwanya and Honorable Nana Tavasha. Oh, and Honorable Tam. Yeah. Can you start Honorable Stone? Don't try to rehearse the conversation.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, actually, thank you, the department, for giving us this report. But my concern, Chairperson, was that we get a report when we are in the house. Before we have, because anything are supposed to give it to us before it goes to us. But my concern, Chairperson, is the news.
I can go there and say, where can I say that the minister must give it to you before it goes to the house?
It doesn't say, but if you check all the inquiries, it starts with the committees. The three inquiries in the commission that was established in this committee. It is came to the committee. Chairperson, my concern is the neutrality of the members of the inquiry. If you check, they are all members of the NDA. Except, no wait, except A. I'm not talking about membership. Because Chairperson, why I'm saying this, if you check page 9 on slide number 17, the African National Congress, Western Cape has presented their page. But there's nothing that it says about DA because the DA is here in Cape Town. Why? That's what I want to find out. Why does that thing happen? If I say I'm just questioning the neutrality of this report. And the other one, Chairperson, is the country that the involvement of...
That's for me to understand. Can you repeat what you're saying? I didn't get you. What are you saying about DA?
I think, Chairperson, if you check on this one, there was no submission to the DA.
That's the question.
Okay. Right. And the other question that I want to find out, the involvement of the council.
The word council. Because
if you check this big report, there was no record from the meeting that was held with the council and the community of the plant. There was no record on this one. It shows that there was no. And then other questions that I want to find out, on page 7, Chairperson. On page 7, the methodology on bullet number 2. When the inquiry, the committee, what I want to get the mandate or the power that they have, because if we check it, they say, if we are not statement in any judicial extent, but they were questionable to add the ministerial inquiry in its investigation. It means there was no power on this committee. It was just an inquiry. If you can get some clarity on that one, Chairperson. And the other one, Chairperson, is on page 10.
Your last point.
On page 10, Chairperson, when we check with page 11. Give me page 11, sir. The court order was obtained to prevent the imminent division of the land during January 2014. But when we check on court findings on page 18, the division on 2nd and 3rd June 2014, not having any authority by court order, were illegal. The subcontradiction. If that can be clarified, because the minister says the vision was illegal. But when we check the February order, it shows that they were legally, they got an order from the court to evict.
According to you, the
actions were
illegal.
For February, it was illegal. And for that one, if they say it was illegal, that's what they want to find the clarity. How can they say it was illegal whenever February when they were illegal?
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Stuart. Honorable Khan.
Thanks very much, Chair, and thanks to the DG for the presentation on the Friday. It has been a very interesting report to read, considering a lot of things that were said when the actual evictions took place, or a few days after the evictions, and all the politics that accompanied the whole eviction and how it was handled. And if one just goes through the report, and look at how this way, you know, of interest to me is that one thing that the commission actually did not apply its mind on or try to find out is who actually led these people into that piece of land. Because on one side, if you read through the report, it says there were 400 spends that were made. But the commission itself has not actually given an indication to say who actually paid this debt, who was actually drawing the pen to say your debt extends from this point A to point Y. That aspect of things remains a mystery now to me, reading through this report, and I've tried my level best reading the report of Friday to read it. From cover to cover, and if there is one failing of the commission, it's actually who led these people, who was taking the stand at this piece of land. Because on one hand it says all right, the 400 stands that were paid, but there's no idea in terms of the people responsible for that, and the report itself is very silent on that. Secondly, and it's very interesting, some of the findings of the report of the commission, in that on one hand the people who are basing or their submission on the absence of houses or the provision of houses in the Western Cape at that starting point, something that led to this to the land invasion. But then what the commission finds is that many people who actually evaded this land, they never actually asked for the state to assist them with the houses. That's what the commission finds. And now I find it difficult to understand how organizations can come in front of the commission and say, oh, it's because the province of the inquiry, let me call it the inquiry, DJ. Can I call it the inquiry? Can I? When I say commission, I mean the inquiry. people appearing before the inquiry and saying all the things that were said, hey, there's no houses, hey, there's no provision of this. But the people who actually were there, they many people, as the finding of the inquiry says, but they've never applied for any house. How that links into the whole thing is... It's quite interesting. It's quite, and this is where I think the department has to answer, is that after the eviction, AGA was given the responsibility to do some work there. But then AGA, in the same way that I think the Honorable Paul was referring, is that after the evictions, there were meetings that were held, steering committee meetings. That meant the first meeting was held by the World Council. But thereafter, an organization came to the party and took control of the steering committee meetings. And the finding on HDA is that HDA was asked to go and compile the list of the people that were evicted. But they actually did not do that. They allowed third parties to do the list for them. That's why that's the finding on HDA, if I can go to it.
No, I'm not questioning your finding. Continue with what you are saying. I'm not questioning what you are saying, so continue.
Yeah. So I just lost a bit of my thoughts there. And I think while I accept that there needs to be education in terms of the property, the people, property owners, you know. But I think more needs to be done in our communities. Because if you look, even if you want it, the info that was provided by the cutler, that it's not that these people didn't know that the land was not available to be occupied. Even the inquiry does find that the community did know that the land is not available. And the cutler did what he could to alert the community, but as the DG said, you know, I'm from Melbourne, so what it means or what it implies, I don't know, mashallah. But in Shangan, I'll say that it must come in cars. That thing that will do it by force. It comes in cars, doesn't matter what you tell us, we are going to stay there. And that, I think, it's an aspect that we need to read in our communities, that people can, even when they are being told that, please, don't go there, they stay go there. And when they are being evicted, then all theories start flying, because it's a media affair, it's changed, and people throw all these things. And I think there's a finding.
Which is going to be your last point, the one that's going to say. It's going to be your last point. And then we'll take another round, so that everybody
else... We'll take another.
Because you can't let people talk alone. There's many people that want to talk.
All right, Chair. There's this one, maybe I just want to check. The sheriff of France calls the meeting. He says, guys, come, there's this issue before us. The sheriff invites the city. The sheriff invites the police and invites Sandra to the meeting. The sheriff even calls the meeting. Obviously, if he calls the meeting, then he must take a meeting. But then, for me, something that I don't understand is that the blame for the non-availability of minutes is extended to everyone else. You know, I call a meeting, you know, we call the DG in here, into the Human Settlement Global Committee. And then, for some reason, they are nominees of the meeting. And then they know the DG must ensure that the minutes are compiled and kept, having been invited by others of the committee to the meeting. And that's something that I have difficulty to understand, to say, maybe the advocate can call me in here. To say, if I am the invitee to a meeting, is it my responsibility to actually ensure that the minutes are taken and kept, if I'm invited to the meeting. When I take a pit stop, that would be my point, and I'll come back on the other part.
Thank you very much. Honorable, I'm Mukwanya.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, TG, for the bomb. At least we did man the meat. What I want to find out, Chair, is what the redress has been embarked on to sort out the discomfort. And also, what lessons have been learned besides stating that people should fence their yards and put guards and so on? What has been learned from this whole occurrence, incident? Also, is there no consequence to the misinterpretation of the court order and in the violation of the PI Act? has there been no, also has there been no follow-up by the victims in terms of wanting, of themselves wanting compensation for the lost property? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Bam. Honorable Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think it will serve us well, Chair, as we go through both the summary of the report and the big report, to avoid making assumptions. Because assumptions sometimes are not helpful. I think what I think as a portfolio committee should do is to appreciate what the minister did to assist in that whole night, that situation. I think this occurrence reminds us of what we always call legacy of apartheid. You know, when the dignity of citizens is taken away from them, they are left with nothing. If they see a piece of land sometimes, because they are disparate, they've been in some corners, in some backyards, in some, you know, a lot of problems. So which means we, this portfolio, the department, the government as a whole, we still have a duty to restore the dignity of South Africans so that they don't find themselves in a situation where they will say, Sianyanzela, or Rivai Bay. In the Southern, they say Rivai Bay, Sianyanzela. So because there's a reason we know why, because it's particular poor people that find themselves in this situation. So which means we had a big lesson from this, is that we must do more, we must move with speed, DG. We must ensure that we address the plight of the poor people of South Africa. Whether they are in a backyard, that we must also ensure that we also educate them. I think because we don't want to condone land invasion. We don't want to condone land invasion. So people must be educated, they must know what they must do. But it will also be proper for members and all of us to know that if you go to any informal settlement in South Africa, because people are so poor, that sometimes they rely on the leaders to tell them what to do, because they are poor, they don't really trust that we are going to help them. So many of them are not on the housing list in many informal settlements. It's not like it happened in that area only, where you can say, now, because they are not on the waiting list, it meant each one houses. No, they trust their government would give them houses. Because their government is taking the people, you know, we are a caring government for our people. So that is why which means we must do more in the informal settlement, in the backyard, to also even take our services to them, for them to register in the waiting list. We know they are not there, so we cannot say no, because that means they didn't. And houses, that would be not correct on our side. So I think the big lesson out of this is that even us as government, sometimes there will be mistakes that are done. Because to evict people in a cold day, that reminds us of our past. So I think we must avoid defending some of these things, but we rather come out, encourage the department to come out with corrective measures for our people. Because these things happen, even in the invasion, we don't want it. We don't want people to invade them. But even authorities must treat people, in particular poor people, they depend on us, must treat them
with good hands, because we still owe them during their own dignity. So we must appreciate that the department intervened. The situation is now corrected. So I think we must not then remain in the past. We must move forward, because there are a lot of other needy people that look upon us. I think department, municipalities, everybody must be educated. I think the lesson from this incident must be taken to all the government institutions. So, and we move forward, give people houses. We don't blame each other. You see, we must appreciate that the minister did something, went around, because if you go and inquire, you must respect the report from yourself. We can't say, no, it's not a judiciary. But it's a report of the person mandated by an authority, which is the minister. I think we must respect it. We can't only say, no, we'll only respect a judiciary kind of an inquiry. So I think it will be taking things to another level. So I think, sir, we must appreciate the minister, must appreciate the department, and request lessons to be spread, and also request speed in addressing the plight of the poor people, and also in educating them on what not to do.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Honourable Papa.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Let me also echo the feelings and sentiment of my colleagues in the satisfaction and happiness on the report that is given to us. And also with the understanding that, to me, it appears that it did achieve what the commissioners and was appointed for. And then things it be informative enough. When I go through the stakeholders and those who were invited, and you also go to the board and find the input. But I'm also now interested in the public situation, whether there are any, I don't know whether it's stakeholders in this case, but it may be interested parties who might have had a lot of interest in the issue and made noise publicly, but did not make submissions or come to make any submissions in entering this report, because that will assist us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Papa.
Thank you, Sir Kevin. What is clear on the master report, from the master report of the minister inquiry and the presentation of the DG slides, it's clear that all of us were not denying that the land was unlawfully occupied. And but the interdict was obtained, and the interdict was for the prevention of new invasions in the land, and there was no authorization of eviction of the people that have invaded the land, but was to prevent. The order was to prevent more people from coming in. So, but it's also clear from the report, from the matter report, that the FANRA subjected itself to the pressure of the city of Cape Town to evict those people. Instead of allowing the city, if the city was in a hurry to evict those people, for the city to evict those people itself. And it's clear that Sandra was not ready and is still not yet ready to develop that piece of land. Because Sandra did not submit a plan, we haven't heard of any plan, that this is the date they've started and show the agents of evicting those people, because on a particular month the plan is ready and we are indeed now implementing the construction of the land, whatever the kind of a project that they want to implement in that particular land, the sand run. So the emphasis here is that the city is now looking at its policies, is now making Sandran a bad boy. But the city of Cape Town is equally involved here. On what happened on that eventful day, where our people, poor people, were evicted during such a situation that has been clearly outlined by my colleague, Honorable Mnemezi here. But somewhere, somehow, there is nothing that prevented any political party that if they have people who were coming to them to complain about the way they've been treated by the city and Sandran, to come forward to the inquiry and make the submission. The fact that the African National Congress of the Western Cape, Western Cape Province came to the fore doesn't mean that other political parties, if the community went to them to complain, were prevented from making submissions. But finally, Chairperson, the work that has been done by the minister and the department and through her inquiry is recommendable, and department and the minister must consider the recommendations by the inquiry and implement them, and then just give a timeline. When are they going to start and when they're giving the message to improve on the recommendations? Like, we support the proposal by that the pie ad must be amended, taking into consideration the experiences that we have witnessed. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And as I'm going to hand over to the department to respond, I'm just interested, Honorable Victoria, when you say the PAC did not submit, are you accepting that IFP is not in Western Cape? Why are you saying IFP did not go to submit? I'm not asking, because everybody that was supposed to submit today. So the interesting thing is that you're talking about DA, you're not talking about your own but IFP. But anyway, can we hear the response from the clarities and questions that were asked? And most of the things that were said, I know that were mainly comments and not necessarily questions, but there were a few questions. If you can just respond to that,
Chair, I will also rely mainly on the legal brains that are sitting right next to me in some of the legally raised questions, so that I avoid exposing my limited knowledge when it comes to matters of legality. But there is one matter I can clarify, that when I say commission could give serious interpretations when we use that terminology, honorable. So we refer to the committee and establish and make an inquiry. Obviously the powers of a commission and that of a committee can never be the same from a legal perspective point of view. Chair, I cannot comment on total neutrality of the committee members. The minister made the appointments, and I have no doubt whatsoever that the members represented on the committee had the caliber to carry the assignment as they did. All submissions could have been received from any party, from any organization, from any political party, and those that were received were then considered, and recommendations have been captured. And then I'll ask the advocate Melanie to deal with the issue that appears to be a contradiction in terms of it, but I don't know whether it's necessary, but I'm sure he can give a clear indication. Maybe this could be a special lecture on Law 101 that advocate Melanie can take advantage of. I wouldn't like to venture into that, Chair. Administratively, Chair, we took responsibility as a department to use one of our agencies, which is HDA, for the administration of the work that was being done here. This was a government work. This was not an NGO work, if I were to put it like that.
towards government work, the government has a responsibility to assign a state institution to be responsible for every work that is being done on this matter. And HDA was identified in the East Local Office to assist the government in this work. I won't go into the...
When you say HDA, you're talking about Housing Development Agency?
I'm talking about the Housing Development Agency, which is a human settlement entity, which will task administratively to manage this process to its conclusion, together with departmental officials, Dr. Sokopo, DDG in Changana, Kwezi, Vose, to be part of the task team to work with SDA on this matter as this of the government responsibility. I will leave other issues that most of them are and I wouldn't like there are lessons that you have learned and that's why we have this report, and I'm sure with time the minister will be applying her mind and arm with a plan of action. This is a case study basically, so to speak, because this is a common phenomenon throughout the country, and this was befitting to say can we do some input and get a sense of and get into the bottom of the challenge we are having throughout the country. And obviously some consequences, legal people will be able to advise the minister appropriately on a matter of this nature if the legal issue has required attention, what could be done, and that includes also what happens in the process, including the loss of property and so forth. I think that requires some legal application of the mind before certain recommendations can be considered once the interpretation of the report has been agreed at a legal level in terms of what could be done based on this report. Chair, I'll leave other issues to Advocate Smilan, maybe to attend to Advocate Smilan.
Thank you very much, DJ. Advocate Smilan, obviously your first point of departure would be to define or clarify the difference between a court interdict and an action order, so that everybody is on the same page.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members, and colleagues.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable members of this committee. On the points raised, I think it is important to remind ourselves why the panel members were specifically selected. The Minister was very keen to ensure that the people that were going to sit and look into the matters were people that firstly had direct knowledge on the issue that affects communities. She was keen to ensure that it's the people that would know and understand how issues of this nature, when they affect communities, they should be responded to. She therefore decided that members that previously served in the Portfolio Committee on Housing, the past administration, could be a useful starting point, as those members or former members of the referendum committee would have had sufficient experience over the years serving the parliament and serving the people to be able to assist this particular committee. That's why the majority of the members are members of or former members of parliament that would have served that committee. So there was an element of deliberateness in terms of people that would immediately be filled with the issues and would not need too much guidance in that way. So that is why those members were chosen. Because the issues also involved law enforcement authorities, there was also felt that it would be important to be guided and to include in this particular panel those that have not only served in Parliament but also specifically served in the Portfolio Committee. So former chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Policy was asked to be available to assist and to use experience in that regard. That is why that particular panel member was specifically chosen as well. So the point about the composition of the panel and their neutrality was deliberately ensured to ensure that not only was their neutrality, but it was really more about closeness of those members to the communities. The procedure that was adopted by the panel, and again it is important to clarify, Chair, that as we respond as the ministry and the department, we are raising this the issues that we raised purely really as observations as well, because remember that the panel was asked to function in an independent fashion so that nobody interfered with its work. So most of the things that were done, we are also observe, we also observe them the way that Brother Despanin would observe them. We had nothing to do whatsoever with what the panel members of the committee did or how they conducted their business. They did that on their own. We observed like everybody else. So what I'm really referring to are specifically our observations as we've read the report, but also as far as they are putting together, at least what we know as a matter of fact. So in respect of the procedure that the committee followed, we observed as well that quite clearly the panel decided that anybody could come forward and make whatever comments they wanted to make. Hence, it was a general public invitation. We saw the notices like everybody else saw notices. And everybody who had something to say was openly invited to come and listen. Therefore, people responded to this. We did note that there were statements by some of the community representatives in the Western Cape, especially from provincial government side, the reservations about the inquiry and the fact that the provincial government did not specifically appear before the inquiry. But what it did do is that together with the city, a submission was submitted to the inquiry. So we were pleased to note that in response to the invitation by the panel for participation by everybody that could assist the panel, there was actually participation by all of the stakeholders in the Western Cape. And we were pleased with that because it demonstrated the seriousness with which the panel was considered by all the stakeholders and the willingness to try and resolve the situation as best as it could. Some of the comments that have been made, I think, are covered by the inputs made by Honorable Nebezi and Honorable Kava as far as the lessons learned. In our respective view, it would not be too relevant at this point in time and for purposes of looking at the report, who would have encouraged or invited people to occupy land. The PIE Act deals with any eviction. It does not qualify what kind of eviction it applies to. All that matters is that there must be an eviction. So which means, irrespective of how the landlord occupied, irrespective of any such circumstance, for as long as there's going to be an eviction of anybody, there would then have to be a procedure stipulated in the PIE Act. And in this particular case, one of the issues that the panel had to look into was whether in this eviction of this community that was affected, the law was followed. All the other considerations would not have been irrelevant because the PIE Act doesn't require that those be considered. It only requires that the process of eviction, are there alternatives that have been provided for those communities? So in that sense, Chair, what has been shown in the report, what has been established, is that there was no eviction order. There was no eviction order, and therefore there should not have been an eviction of anybody. That is as the law, as best as we understand it, and that is how we understand the judgment. So there was no misinterpretation of any legal order. There was no misinterpretation. There was a misapplication, and there was an unlawful process that was followed. Now, observations and what you've seen in the report, and what whole country and the whole world that matter saw on television, is that there appears clearly to have been a coordinated effort to have those people removed. Coordinated in the sense that if you look at all of the various individuals that were there representing different structures, we had the official of the city there in the form of the metro, in the city police of Cape Town. You had the other law enforcement agencies who were asked to come and assist in the process in the form of the SAPS. And in clearing out that
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Jackson. So in a sense, our observation and the reading of the report is that there was no misinterpretation. There was just a misapplication of the court order, and there was an unlawful process that took place. So what we, as the people of this country, saw on television in the humanitarian crisis that was caused by the manner in which that incident was illegally converted into an aviation court was something that when we've seen it before, we don't have that experience. And there's a lot of evictions that take place in the country, but this is the one where we have seen that instead of following the court order as it is, this one was done slightly differently. So the lessons learned here, as the Honourable Member correctly pointed out, needs to be learned, is that as best as all of us can, and as much as an eviction is necessary, it is important to follow the law to the letter. And we must start to ensure that the law is followed at all times. So one of the things that will be undertaken immediately after this process is an engagement with the departments of those that were involved and were affected, with a view to engaging with them to ensure how this cannot be allowed to happen again, irrespective of the circumstances that may seem to justify that it happens. So a proper interpretation of court orders is necessary. We're quite available and willing to assist, make sure is assured in the future. What Honourable Ghana Tabashe raised is very important as well. We... Our observation is exactly as she also observed, and I think Chair, the report does talk to this, and it talks to whether or not there was even a need for eviction to have taken place. What we understand happened there is that there was some complaints made to the province by some community members, which complaint was forwarded to the city, and the city in turn then wrote a threatening letter to SANRAL to deal with the community that occupied its land. What subsequently happened after that quite clearly appeared to have been a coordinated effort to have those members of that community removed. We have tried to look at the report to see if there was any agency in the removal of that particular community. It doesn't appear to have been raised by any of the parties that appeared before the panel. In other words, nobody seemed to make a case for the immediate need for the community to be removed from that piece of land. So there's clearly nothing urgent about it. So we would have been keen to understand why it was necessary at that particular point in time. So the misapplication of the court order therefore is something that would worry us, because it does suggest some deliberateness and coordination in the way in which it was carried out. But as far as the lessons are concerned, we will be proceeding to argue and seek the rest of the country to support the efforts that the department would be taking to educate communities, to also and primarily seek to have a moratorium that the minister has called already, and recently the deputy president has called that there must be a moratorium on evictions across the country, including in the farming communities. Simply because when you do an eviction is a brutal process. It is a brutal process because, as the word says, you evict. It is something that can be done forcefully, but only if the court authorizes it under circumstances that the court itself would have considered appropriate under the circumstances. So a moratorium, as correctly been called, is something we will continue to advocate as the ministry and as the department to assure that the consequences that usually follow within a vision are avoided, because it is generally the, as Honorable Mays indicated, it's the suffering of the poor that happens. In Rwanda we saw how people were manhandled physically, were assaulted, children couldn't write exams. Specific letters the minister has to facilitate be reaching to employers of those members who are affected, with a view to seeking relief for them to be excused from work while they look after their property that had been damaged and lost, as the case may be. So the humanitarian crisis that comes usually with an eviction of the type that we saw, and the legal, an illegal one at that, is something that we'll be keen to make sure is never repeated again. So the members of the inquiry and those that participated in this, we're grateful for the information that they shared. We're grateful for them being available to share their painful experience, and we undertake to take their experience and make sure that what they went through was not in vain. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Advocate Melanie. We really didn't want to be seeing ourselves rehearsing the inquiry itself, because it's not really going to assist us. The inquiry took place for 2 months, and this is a report in front of us that we are looking at. Whilst we would have some unhappiness in some areas, I really would want us to focus on the recommendations themselves of the inquiry. And actually, the committee members, the honourable members, if they can, probably confine themselves to the recommendations. Because if you look at the recommendations are taking us forward in terms of what needs to happen in what we need, and in terms of how we then manage the whole process of evictions in the future. Can I hear people talking about around the recommendations, rather than wanting to talk about who went, who didn't, and why didn't they go, and who went for who, and why did who? Please, you're not going to assist us that much now. If we can just talk on the recommendations and see if it takes us forward as a committee. Another room, Neme.
I want to propose that as the committee, we must support the recommendations to ensure that the poor communities are protected by us as a whole. So I think they support the recommendations.
Thank you. Honorable Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few observations and concerns. One with regards to the implied comment of the city of Cape Town hastily removing the people, whereas in other parts of the report we've got recommendations made that oversight by local governments should be monitored by more stringently monitored by provincial and even obviously national government as well. Does this not perhaps the practice of that oversight? Just a question. Where you, that would be the common practice. Land is invaded, the local authority notifies the landowner. Landowner is then charged with taking action. Is that not oversight by local government? Just a question. With regards to the urgency of the evictions, given the time frame that's already been spelled out for us, and the fact that whether it was being legally or illegally implemented, the PI Act was being invoked and being used, was that time frame not what was being taken into consideration? Hence the urgency, just another question. And on recommendation number 12, I just have a bit of a concern. We'll be saying SAP must develop separate national instructions to deal with evictions. The responsibility for the land evictions is not essentially the responsibility of SAP, is it? They are then the implementers. They are there to assist as an entity. So I'm just worried about the contradiction that may arise from that. How would this separate national instruction comply with the human settlements policies? Thank you.
Honourable Baker, in terms of the recommendation, your concern is around the exact one, but generally the other recommendations. Yeah, the other recommendations you find, all right. Honourable Tone?
Finish your question. Your question, mine is on recommendation number 25. The inquiry finds that standard faith to take sufficient steps to protest is less. What I want to further this one is that what was the intake of transport? Because the standard is the entity of transport department. And the other one, Chairperson, the next one is what action has been taken for SESICON leadership? Because that thing was corrected by SESICON.
Can you talk about the recommendation? I hear you, SESICON. What are you saying about this recommendation? You are happy with the recommendation. I'm noting you, Honorable Guy, but I'm just looking at other people before I give it to you. I'm trying hard to ignore you as much as I can. Honorable Papa?
You fine with the recommendation?
Yeah, I'm just fine.
Honorable Pam, you filed the recommendation?
No, Chairperson, paragraph 19 of the recommendation. I'm not sure I'm getting the sense that maybe I don't understand.
You find with the recommendations except paragraph 19 for now. Okay. Thank you very much. Honorable Ghana.
Thank you, Chair. I think there's something that the NNS advocate says that I think it's important that we follow up on. Well, on our side, we're placing a moratorium on, and it goes back to the point that I said earlier, on eviction. We must also discourage the evasion of land, because evictions can only happen if land has been evaded. If there's no invasion of land, then there's no need for eviction. Land and property. Land and more property, because some invasions, people just see an empty block of land and they move in. So if I say land, it could be that if there's a land, then it's not so. And that I want to agree with the advocate that we must at all times follow the letter of the law. And in instances, and when I did do a pit stop, I was about to get to the point of Sandral and the city. If the city is an invasion of private land and does nothing, according to the project, it will come back by them. Because the 14-day notice is not, the city did not invent the 14-day notice that is to Sandral. Because the city cannot go and evict people on the land that doesn't belong there. City, according to the PI Act, has to tell the landowner to say, hey, your land is being invaded there, and you have to act. And when the city does that, I find this, in a way, surprising that we blame the city for having followed the heart of the law, which is the PI Act. Because if the city keeps quiet and people just invade private land, and come back and say, the city is not responsive. And that's the light of the law needs to be looked on both sides on what the responsibility of local government, the province and national is. In terms of the recommendations, these are lessons. And what I see in here, Chair, is in a way, if we can create a bit of a template, if we are to, I'm just thinking that if there's an invasion, let's say tomorrow there's an invasion in Nepal, that's the place where I come from, so there will never be invasion. I didn't want to put any other place, because they will think that I'm targeting someone. Then what then this does is that it gives us, it's more like a lead, you know, a checkbox, to say, one, was there a way to secure the property? No or yes. Was the court order done? Was the SAPS informed and everyone else was involved? So from that aspect, it's good. But the important thing, as I said, I go back to what the learners advocate said, is that let's educate our people. That if they learn, just because the land is not being developed, doesn't make it available for occupation. Because that thing will actually, in a way, limit the number of evictions that we do. But unless you can actually stop the invasion, you cannot tell a property owner not to come and claim that his or her property, even if in this case it can be the government or the state of government that owns the land, that maybe the land is earmarked for a school, we say, you're putting a moratorium on building that school because you can't evict people. And the city has planned for that land, or if the provincial government or the national government has planned for that land either to build a road, to build a school. Now, when you put that moratorium, what then becomes the impact in the disdeliver? Because it's not only private land that gets invaded. Sometimes the land came out for health services, for educational facilities that people stay in there. So now, when we talk of this, we're not only looking at I'm being subsidized.
I'm wanting you to finish off.
Alright. Oh, time. Oh, do we get lunch? Alright. But I think this measure of a moratorium needs to be looked at. Because it can actually stop us from delivering services. Because people have invaded land. Even when you want to build these integrated communities, people stay there. Now what do you do? You say, no, we must not evict people, but you want to go into this, what do you call this? You want to address a special pattern. Because people are saying, we want to build this integrated community, but you have placed a moratorium. Now what do you do as a department? But it cannot just be looked at in terms of the land that's owned by private citizens. It's the land that the government has also earmarked for development that we have to look at. So the moratorium aspect needs to be properly motivated in terms of what we mean and which areas we need to look at. But it cannot just be a blanket moratorium that will actually have a development of our community space.
And another to Ghana, the important thing is that in all that you said, the recommendations are good.
Special recommendation number 16.
Yeah.
That one is, yeah. That's the key, number 16. Yeah. I must be number 16.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I think you meant that one, the rest I will go.
Honorable Chairman, can you take us to number 2 recommendation? You can see there, I know when you were debating this thing, you said, Ibushungu. You're still sitting there with that pain in your eyes. But the recommendation is Honorable Chairman. Please can you
comment
about
them? Okay, I support the recommendation. The only thing that I was not happy and I'm not clear what's going to happen. There is nothing that says there should be a public apology. If I listen to advocate that there was a misapplication of a court order, so to me, to the affected families or people, a public apology by the person who misapplied the court order is it will make me happy because I'm still pleading in my mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. I know you are very pleading even that day. Thank you very much. We're talking about the recommendation. I don't want any other speeches. I just want to hear about the recommendation. Honorable Kurai, no speeches. Recommendation.
No, Chair, support the recommendation.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mungana
Kurashen.
No, Chair, now I support the recommendation. All of them.
Thank you very much, Honorable members. You know, the whole point, I think what we need to take out of this is the fact that, and even the report itself, where it explains how then we deal with future evictions when they happen, or how to prevent them. And I think for me, lessons learned from Helwandle, regardless of how it happens, who did it, why they did it,
what purpose is. We need to learn from it so that we don't sit here as a nation, as a department, and repeat the same thing every day as if we are not learning anything from this thing. So the important thing about this report is that then it empowers us, I'm hoping. It empowers the department, it empowers everybody else involved to know what is it that needs to happen when these kind of things happen. And I'm hoping that this report is going to be made public to everybody, particularly the recommendations, particularly the municipalities, particularly the provinces, so that at least they have got this tool to guide them and to help them on how to deal with addictions in the future. Thank you very much, honorable members. You have enriched this committee in the discussion. I would have let you discuss more. I am mindful of the fact that there is a sitting in the afternoon at 2, and I'm also mindful of the fact that members must go and have something to eat before they go to the house at 2, and I'm also mindful of the fact that you've been here since 10 o'clock. I just want to thank the department for availing themselves to be here, to be able to give the report, be able to answer questions and answers that we wanted. Members of the media, thank you for staying with us throughout this time. You made some of the committee members very happy today. I'm not going to say who, but I know that the members of the committee are very happy today because the media has been here throughout. There's always been a question, where is the media? So thank you very much. I think the meeting is adjourned now. As the committee, we will be meeting again next week today. And you remember next week Tuesday, we will be briefing.